I met our guest today, Martin Tanner, at the IANS Conference, International Association for Near-Death Studies. Martin Tanner, BA, JD, has been deeply involved in near-death experience research since the late 1980s, when he co-founded the Utah chapter of IANS. Since 1990, he has been chair of Utah IANS. He's currently vice president and a member of the board of directors of the International Association for Near-Death Studies in Durham, North Carolina. Martin has personally interviewed over 600 people who've had a near-death experience, as well as leading researchers on the topic. For three decades, he's hosted a weekly radio show where he was among the first to interview on the radio many of the pioneers in NDE research, including Raymond Moody, MD, PhD, George Ritchie, MD, Professor Emeritus Ken Ring, Professor Bruce Grayson, MD, Melvin Morse, MD, and many others. Originally, he was a skeptic, and now he's convinced NDEs are real. He's even debated representatives of the American Atheists and the Skeptical Inquirer. Martin has presented at the annual IANS conference on TV and radio about NDEs. So, someone who's spoken to 600 people about the topic has some really remarkable stories to share. I think you'll really enjoy today's conversation. Hey, everyone. I'm really excited to let you know about the Science and Spirituality Salons I'm now hosting. During these intimate events, a scientifically verified psychic medium will give all of you readings, and I will give a talk on the science and evidence that changed my mind about an afterlife. This will also be an amazing opportunity to get to meet some of you in person or virtually, and to share more about all the science and data that transformed my worldview and got me through my worst days. These can be hosted in your home, in a nearby cafe with a private room, or they can even be virtual. I've hosted a few already, and they were really special, fascinating, emotional, evidential. So if you're interested in getting a small group together over dinner, brunch, drinks, coffee, to learn more about the science and to get evidential medium readings, send me an email at hello@wtfjusthappened.net and put science and spirituality in the title. Today's episode comes with a content warning. We touch upon some slightly intense topics such as murder and suicide. However, since we are discussing near-death experiences, if these topics are sensitive for you, we do think this episode could be healing. But I want you to know we do discuss those topics. Welcome to What the Fuck Just Happened. I'm your host, Liz Enten. If you listened to the intro, you know my story. If not, here's a brief summary. I'm a science-y skeptic, and when my dad died, I took a shot in the dark and decided to investigate if there was any possible evidence of an afterlife. I assumed that was as realistic as Santa Claus, but I was desperate. However, I was so blown away by what I discovered that I wrote a book and launched this podcast. In this podcast, I'll be talking to some fairly normal people about some really weird shit. I speak with everyone from psychic mediums and afterlife researchers to ordinary people who've had some inexplicable experiences. So come, listen. There's no need to draw any final conclusions. Keep an open mind and wonder, what the fuck just happened?
I am speaking with Martin Tanner today. I'm a co-founder of Utah IONS, and I'm also on the board of directors for International IONS and its current vice president. That's me in a nutshell.
Welcome. It's great to see you.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Liz.
You. I know we both talked quite a bit at the IONS conference about how we're both varying degrees of skeptical. I think I'm probably still a little more skeptical, though the evidence is pretty compelling at this point. So when did what made you take the skeptical approach?
That's a great question. I have decided that I will not just believe something because somebody tells me. I always like to assume something, you know, might be true, but I will not just take it on somebody's word. I'll look into it. And I've also made a decision in life to not sort of cherry pick for things that will support the position I like. I try really hard to let the facts lead me wherever they're going to lead me and, you know, not try to impose my preconceived notions on the world. So those are my own personal philosophies, and that's led to the idea that I'm going to maybe, you know, trust but verify, to use a political phrase, or look into something if somebody suggests that it's real rather than just automatically believing it.
Yeah, I relate to all of that because, of course, who doesn't want to believe all this is real, but, you know, don't want to lie to yourself, or I just feel like I can't, even if I told myself everything's 100% true. I mean, now, again, the evidence has really built up where I'm more convinced I ever was, but I can't tell myself 100%, even though that obviously would make me very, very happy. But I would say I'm up to 90%, which going from 0% to 90% is a big change.
You know, I in undergrad school, I took a philosophy class, and it was on epistemology, which is the study of knowledge. What can people know? And when you get right down to it, people know very little. Now, there's a lot of evidence for many, many things, but absolute knowledge, you probably can't say much more than you know you exist because you think, and you may have a really high degree of certitude that other people do as well because you interact with them and it kind of spreads out from there. And beyond that, most of what we say we know is just what we believe because it's from a source that we deem to be credible. One of the earliest radio shows that I ever had was kind of hilarious because it was with a guy named Johnson. I can't remember his first name, but he was the president of the International Flat Earth Society. And he genuinely, truly believed the world was flat. And it was funny because I would let callers call, and most of them could not flat out prove, no pun intended, could not prove that he was wrong. They just said, you're crazy, or I don't believe you, or what about NASA and the space flights? And they were all using secondary information, which is what most of us do for everything. And this guy finally called in, who'd been a test pilot for NASA, and he says, oh, I've flown at 90,000 feet and I've seen the curvature of the Earth. And then what could John say? He just kind of said, well, you're a liar. I mean, that's all he had left. But hey, most of us don't know a lot of things we think we know. We just have a lot of evidence for them.
I think it's a very unlikely explanation, but we could be in a simulation and just being the only person seeing everyone around us.
Yeah.
That's varying degrees of levels of knowledge. You know, there's 95%, 99.9%, but when you come down to 100%.
Not much that's 100%.
Not really, no. So what did you think about the possibility of an afterlife before you started getting into NDEs?
So I was born into a fairly religious home. And so I went to church and was taught from an early age, you know, there's a God and an afterlife and so forth. But when I got to be a little bit older and, you know, fifth or sixth grade, I was still a little kid and I would read all these books about dinosaurs and cavemen and, you know, prehistoric animals. I talked to my mother who had a degree in biology, and she said, and I said, what's the deal? You know, dinosaurs in the Garden of Eden, what's the deal? The earth millions of years old or a few thousand years old, or what's the story? And she said, you know, don't worry about that, Martin, because whatever is true in religion will not be contradicted by science. And whatever is true in science will not be contradicted by true religion. But there's a lot of stuff in both that isn't really true. And she had a degree in biology, and that was something that I respected and had a great deal of confidence in. So the truth, wherever you find it, is great. But that sort of led me to be skeptical about lots of different things and to really look in them before I would just automatically believe.
When did you first hear of NDEs and start getting interested in them?
I was in undergraduate school, getting ready to apply for law school, and I ran across Raymond Moody's book, which is the first one on ever published on near-death experiences, Life After Life. And I read it through in one afternoon. It was so cool. I just thought, wow, this is neat. And a couple of years later, I got a weekend radio show and tracked Moody down and had a great four-hour conversation with him on the radio, because I wanted to, again, hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak, and wanted to hear what Moody actually had to say. And it was a really fun discussion. He's a good guy. He's a skeptic. He's an MD, PhD, and his PhD is in philosophy, and he knows about what's required for absolute proof. And his new book that just came out, Proof of Life After Life, is talking about, after all these years, he wrote his book in 76, he's finally come to the point where he thinks the evidence is overwhelming enough that it's real. So he's kind of still a skeptic in a way, but pushed over the top.
So at that point, you thought there was no afterlife, or you believed the biblical?
I guess I would say that I'd done enough research to know that there was a historical person named Jesus, and there were stories about an afterlife, but I wanted to look into it. And I guess I would describe myself as a hopeful agnostic. Maybe would be a good way to describe it.
Then you spoke with Raymond Moody. And what did you think of after that call? Because that was your first introduction to near-death experiences.
That was my first introduction. And I thought, this kind of makes sense, because it fits in with a lot of narratives that you hear from all kinds of different religious traditions about people die, their spirits move on, there are different ideas. In Hindu faith, there's reincarnation, you're reborn over and over again. In Judeo-Christian traditions, you have an afterlife in some other place and in some other context, but they all have the idea that when you die, life isn't over forever. There are even some brands of Christianity that think when you die, you sleep and you wake up at the time of the resurrection off whenever that happens. So different ideas, but they all have the idea of an afterlife, or at least most of them do. So I thought that was fascinating, the tie-in between near-death experiences and religion. And so that intrigued me. And I'm now convinced that many of the pivotal religious events that are described in the Bible and in other religious books are based on the same kinds of experiences that we would now describe as near-death experiences. There are a whole bunch of them.
Can you give me an example of one?
Sure. I would be happy to do that.
Yeah, I'm an atheist and I've never read the Bible, so I have to be honest. I genuinely, I'm not just having you say this for my audience. I probably have not heard this story. So I want to hear it.
So there's this interesting account early on in the Bible about Moses. And he's the guy that leads the children of Israel out of Egypt and stuff. And why does he do all this? Well, he sees God. And how does God appear to him? It's described as he appears in fire, in a burning bush, and the bush is never consumed. And if you look at that long ago, what would be one of the brightest things you could look at? It would be fire. And what do people see in near-death experiences? They typically see someone who either comes to them, as in George Ritchie, who's glowing and bright and brilliant, who Dr. George Ritchie described as brighter than welder's lamps. You know, he's using a modern metaphor. Well, back in the Old Testament era, the metaphor was in fire, in a burning bush that's never consumed. So I think that's something that's a very near-death-like experience. If you want to jump to the New Testament, Paul talks about leaving his body, or whether in his body or out, he says, and going up to the third heaven. And that's a description that sounds very near-death-like experience to me. And you could come up with some others as well. Stephen describes, as he's being stoned to death, he's a guy who met a very difficult fate. And as he was being killed, he sees God and Jesus in the heavens. Apparently, he sees something bright off in the distant light. And that's what people who have near-death experiences see.
That sounds like out-of-body experiences. And, you know, I mean, I'm not going to comment on something haven't really delved into, like, the way I've delved into out-of-body experiences. But yeah, I mean, these all could have been the stories taken the same way we take Robert Monroe's stories.
That's right.
Then just all these inexplicable reports.
To give another really quick example, one of the newer, more unusual examples. I'm in Utah, right? So here's the head of the Mormon faith, and its founder Joseph Smith describes seeing a pillar of light come down from heaven, in which he is given a bunch of instructions by God and Jesus. Pillar sounds a lot like a tunnel, and bright and glorious, that's a near-death experience type description. It's very much like the one that George Ritchie gave of Jesus coming to him rather than going to a tunnel in connection with death. So that would be another modern example of one.
And who is George Ritchie?
George Ritchie is a medical doctor. Forgive me, I should have given more background. And he was a colleague of Raymond Moody. As a matter of fact, Raymond Moody had found a couple of patients who had described these, and he goes to his colleague, George Ritchie, and says, "You ever heard anything like this?" He said, "Yeah, I had one." And what happened was George Ritchie, who was a psychiatrist, had caught pneumonia in World War II as a young 21-year-old soldier and died, you know, before they had much to help somebody who had a severe pneumonia. He had pneumonia in both lungs, and he just died. They put a sheet over him and hauled him off to the morgue. And during his experience, he saw Jesus come to him, and he said, "I guess I'm kind of glad I'm dead, because this is so bright, it would probably burn the retinas in my eyes." He has some kind of funny little comments in there. And then he's taken around and shown different places in the universe. He's taken above the earth and shown a whole bunch of things. Quite an interesting short little book called Return from Tomorrow, one of my favorites. I knew George Ritchie quite well and spoke with him many, many times over dinner, and great man, really good guy. He died in 2008, so he's no longer with us, but good man. That's George Ritchie.
Oh, yeah. We've gotten to meet some pretty impactful people in this afterlife evidence world.
That I have.
Now, so you interviewed Raymond Moody, and you were like, "This is amazing. There's something going on here." What was your next step? Did you start interviewing some other people?
I did. My next step was I heard from Raymond Moody about George Ritchie, who we just discussed. And I first talked to him on the radio and then invited him to come to Salt Lake City. And we chatted for a couple of days, and he spoke here in Utah. And then I tried to find more people. And I found that when I asked around, there were a lot of people who were willing to volunteer, but that was sort of back in the era when it was not well known. And so I tracked down from Seattle Betty Eady, who wrote quite a famous book called Embraced by the Light that sold millions of copies through Macmillan. I just tracked down dozens and dozens. I've interviewed well over 600 people who have had near-death experiences. And so I really enjoy it. A lot of them have been adults, and some of them have been children. And some of the most interesting experiences for me are children, because they would not have the ability to, or the personal history or connection with either religion or atheism or some other point of view to come up with some real world model that they would use to make something up with, or to have a hallucination or dream about. Some of the young little kids who have these are kind of hilarious the way they describe them. Very interesting.
What was some of the children's NDEs that stood out to you?
There was a little kid who was with his family in a car on a road by Puget Sound in Seattle, and it was wintertime and there was ice and they slid off the road. The car went into the water in Puget Sound. And ultimately, he was saved from that experience. The paramedics came, and he had a short little near-death experience. And he's talking to his doctor afterwards. And part of the description that he has was his family is not particularly religious. And so his doctor, who's to this day a friend of mine, Dr. Melvin Morse, interviews this little kid and says, "Oh, so what happened to you?" And he describes what happened and seeing the events from below and how fun it was to go off to this other place. And he said, "Well, so did you die?" And the little kid, "Oh no, when you die, that's when they put you in a box and bury you in the ground. I went to a really fun place, Dr. Moore. Someday you will see." And so it's kind of a cool little account from a kid who didn't associate his near-death experience with death at all, which is kind of cool. Another really fun one was, for me anyway, and it's one of the ones that pushed me over the top to be more of a believer than a skeptic, was a little girl named Crystal who drowned in a swimming pool in Pocatello, Idaho. She was there with a bunch of other little girls for a birthday party, and she wasn't a very good swimmer, so she's walking around the deep end of the pool because she couldn't swim across and to get to some friends on the other side. And some bigger kids ran by to the diving board and bumped her, and she fell in the pool. So many people in the pool, she just slipped down to the bottom, and that was it. And as near as people could gather from the description, she was on the bottom of the pool for over 20 minutes. And she was in a deep coma for several days. And she woke up and tells Dr. Morse, who at the time was kind of agnostic. He didn't have any serious religious background or belief at the time. Morse asked this little girl, Crystal, who woke up, what happened, expecting to hear how she had drowned. And her story was, "Oh, you mean when I went to heaven?" And he says, "Yeah, tell me about this." And so she did. To this day, I'm friends with Crystal as well. She's all grown up and she's a social worker now. But that was a pivotal one for me, because I thought, this little girl's not making up the story, and her attending physician verifies the thing that she said, and her parents were able to verify the details of what was going on in her home, which she was able to share with her family and with me. And I thought, nobody'd make a little kid, the centerpiece of some conspiracy or something. Nobody make up a story for publicity or some other purpose and have a little kid who couldn't keep a story straight. So that one was important for me to hear.
Yeah. And we've had Dr. Melvin Morse on this episode, on this podcast. He's fascinating.
He may have told you about Crystal then. That's great.
I think so, but you both told different perspectives of it. So, I feel like you can't hear these stories enough. There's so much richness to them, Said you have heard of a bunch of persuasive NDEs, or I don't want to say a bunch, but a selection of that are less known that we can't just easily Google and find or read about. I'd love to hear about some of those.
Sure. One of the ones that was the most impactful to me was a guy named David Herard. And David Herard was, he grew up back east, as I recall, in Philadelphia. And he had some friends who were killed in gang violence. And so he was really angry, just an angry kid. And as he got done with high school, it was about the time the Vietnam War was coming along. And he was so bitter and angry, he enlisted in the Marines so that he could, in his own words, kill people without going to jail. I mean, that was his mindset. He was just an angry, angry guy, not a believer in anything, and kind of an atheist, maybe an agnostic. So he's over in Vietnam, and I tracked him down. I don't think he shared his story very much. And he's telling me this story, and I could see how emotional it was for him. And he's in Vietnam, and the Tet Offensive is happening, and the Viet Cong are coming towards their group, and they practically overwhelmed them, and the Marines that he was with were running out of ammo, and they were receiving so much incoming fire that no one was willing to go back to the ammo cache to get more ammo so that they could fight back. Everybody thought they'd just get shot up and die. So David Herard says to himself, screw it, except you use much more colorful language, part of which is in the title of your podcast. And he said, I don't care if I die, whatever. And so he just runs off and gets a bunch of ammo and dumps a bunch in a foxhole, and the Marines cheer, and he goes back and forth two or three or four times. And the final time that he attempted it, a rocket-propelled grenade lands close to him and basically filled him with shrapnel. And as I'm telling his story, this was in the summer, and he had on a t-shirt and cutoffs, and he shows me he has, you know, whole big scars in his arms and at the top of his chest and you in his legs, and you could just see this is not a made up story. And what happened was that he makes it back to the foxhole, and his intestines were coming out. They had to be put back in. He was stapled up. He was in horrible shape, and he died. And he said that Jesus held him and told him that everything would be okay and filled him with love. And it's one of the most touching things that I've ever heard, to see this guy who was angry and bitter and an atheist to hear that in this near-death experience that he was filled with love and knew about an afterlife and somebody who cared about him. And he comes back a changed man. He's just a totally different guy. And his family doesn't know him very well. They don't understand why he's changed. It's really tough for him, but he just could never be the same again. And ultimately, he became a paramedic and spent the rest of his life off tracking down hikers who had accidents or had become lost in the wilderness up by Bangor, Maine. And he finally died just a couple of years ago, beginning of the COVID pandemic. Great guy. There's a guy who totally changed. Atheist to believer, from angry to a loving, caring person, from self-centered to altruistic, just, I mean, nothing could change you like that if it wasn't real. That was a huge one.
And he changed instantaneously after this experience.
That experience right then changed him all at once.
I am curious, because you've mentioned quite a few people seeing Jesus on the other side, and this is speculative, you know, and again, I'm very, very respectful of anyone's beliefs. So this is just me, atheist Liz, asking, Why do you think people see religious figures? Do you think, in your opinion, does it speak to the genuineness of a form of a god or religion? Or is it people's interpretations of something that, you know, that's language we have here?
That is a very astute question, and one that I ask every time somebody mentions a religious figure, because it's an important question. And I will answer it the way that the people who have these experiences answer them. There are people who make assumptions based on their own personal background about who the person is that they see or what's going on. And that's only natural because, hey, what else can you do? You can't make assumptions from somebody else's background or history. It's got to be from your own. And so typically, for example, if you have a Muslim and they have a near-death experience, they're not going to say they saw God because they believe God's a spirit and not seeable. And so they see the angel Gabriel, who's a pivotal figure in their belief system. So that's who they identify this figure with. There are other people who just say it's the source. There was a guy who was on the IONS board named Chuck Swedrock. He not a big fan of organized religion. And so for him, it's the source. And if you talk about God or Jesus or any religious lingo, it burns his ears. He doesn't like it. So different people have different vernacular. However, there are a few people, and I suppose one of the reasons that I brought up the stories to you that I did was because there are a few people who say it was Jesus that saved them. And Richie was the first one like this for me, because before George Richie, the people who I had interviewed, although he was among the first, would say, I saw a bright light and I saw God. And with him, he said it was Jesus. And I said, well, how do you know it was Jesus? I just knew. Well, how did you know? Did he tell you? It was more than him telling me. When you're on the other side, it's telepathy. It's communication that is precise and perfect and cannot be misunderstood. When people speak in language, there are nuances and subtleties and miscommunications, and we all know about those because we live with them every day, where people say things and you think you've conveyed something, but you really haven't, or you misunderstand when people talk, but apparently on the other side, things are very precise. And Dr. Richie said, it was Jesus. I knew that because when he appeared, I was told, stand up, you are in the presence of the Son of God. And David Harrard was told that as well. It's probably a very small percentage of near-death experiences where someone is actually told who it is. I've never bothered to try to figure out the percentage, but I think it's a very, very low percentage. In the new after-death film that's just recently out, which I saw the world premiere of a couple of weeks ago, that's fabulous. There are a few of the experiences in there, like Mary Neal and Howard Storm, who specifically saw Jesus. There are others who just saw a being of light. I don't know anybody who's had near-death experience and said, hi, Jesus. And they said, no, it's not Jesus, it's Gabriel, you know, or somebody who's had some assumption and they've been corrected. I don't think God works like that. I think the main purpose isn't to correct little misunderstandings. It's just to send people back with the idea that the purpose of life is to love other people and to help people and to learn things. The second biggest thing that people are usually told is knowledge is important. And so often people will start a new career or start to read voraciously, and it just changes their life in that way as well.
Yeah. And I can imagine, I know myself, and it seems you as well, just studying it, it's changed my life. Yeah. Experiencing it so unexpectedly, I can't pretend to say I understand what a transformation that quickly, that intensely, that drastically would be like.
Yeah. I think the closest to that that everyone has before they die is maybe the death of a loved one, the unexpected death of a loved one. That is instantly transformational in a lot of ways, sometimes in a really bad way, a sad way. I had a 22-year-old daughter who died in 2016, and that was instantly a really huge, huge deal for me. We were very, very close. But yeah, we were very close, and for quite a while after it, I was very sad. And now I sort of reflect on the good things, and I just miss her. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing her again. But the point is that for our purposes today, though, is the instant transformation. People experience things like that all the time, just not so much in a near-death context. But it is huge for people who experience it. To your point earlier, nobody's got it all figured out. There will not be anyone who dies who isn't surprised about something or who doesn't learn something new. There will be nobody who's got it all figured out. So whether you choose to think of the being of light on the other side as Jesus or Muhammad or the angel Gabriel or the source like Chuck does, I think for me that's incidental.
Yeah, I personally, I guess, don't identify with religious words, but I mean, who cares? As long as I see my loved ones again and know that I'll continue, because I started this research based on the loss of my dad. So call it whatever you want. I just want to see him again and the people I've lost since then and know that I won't be obliterated.
Yeah.
It's a very, very complex concept for us material beings to understand. And we find what words resonate with us, and you know, you have to find the words that resonate and hopefully bring you comfort, and you can share with others to bring comfort.
That's right. Sorry for the loss of your dad. That's rough.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
I should tell you an interesting story about a friend of mine who lost his dad and then got to see him again briefly during his near-death experience. You might like this one because it's really unusual. This is really different. So I have a friend named Ted Whiting, who also lives in the Salt Lake City area. And his father worked for the DEA and was undercover in Florida. And somehow he was found out that he was a DEA guy. And so the drug dealers were trying to kill him and catch him. And so he fled and took his family and came to Utah and figured he was safe. And at this point, I think Ted was a young kid, like six or seven. And the bad guys find him again. And so he leaves his family here and he sort of disappears and goes to Montana. And there he thinks he's fine and gets a few friends. And all of a sudden, nobody knows where he is. And it turned out that Ted's father and his friend, along with their, you know, favorite little dog, were off out in a boat fishing in one of the big lakes. Might have been Great Slave Lake, anywhere. One of the big lakes in Montana. And their boat was found, but they weren't. And they finally tracked them down. And what had happened is somebody had duct taped their hands together and wrapped them up in a net and put some bricks in it and threw them overboard. And so his dad drowned. So all these years, Ted has this knowledge that his father drowned, and he didn't know his dad from the time that he was pretty young, and he missed him even though he didn't know him very well. And so Ted has this rather bizarre experience with a sinus surgery gone bad, where he briefly dies and has a near-death experience. And he finds himself on the other side, and he doesn't see God, he doesn't see Jesus, but he sees a whole bunch of people, some of whom he knows and some he doesn't know, who are sort of there to greet him. And one of them is his father, who he instantly knows. And so he has this chat with him, and they're walking off in this location, kind of off out in nature. They're walking over trees and paths. And so they're having this kind of surreal conversation. It's, gee, Dad, I really felt bad that you died. I wish that you'd been there more. Yeah, Ted, I wish I'd been there more. You know, it's kind of rough when you get murdered. You know, you're just not around for your family. Dad, I've always wondered, was it really bad to drown? I just feel really bad. Well, Ted, you know, when you take that first breath of water, it's really not too good. But after that, it's not so bad. I'm thinking, here are two people talking about it's not really that bad to drown. And I'm thinking, no one would make that up. But anyway, so they have this long conversation and kind of bond again. And ultimately, his dad says, you know, Ted, you've got to go back. This is not your time, but I'm glad we had a chance to reconnect. And so Ted has to go back. But I thought it was cool that he saw his dad again and that they're having this really odd conversation about how drowning isn't all that bad. And it's just kind of strange. But it was a wonderful experience, a great description. He spoke at Utah and Sierra a couple of years ago. It's a great story.
I actually got chills over that story. So I think we can probably apply that to all ways of passing. Us on the material side, we see our person passing, and it's just, it looks like a level of suffering we can't even fathom. But we start studying and hearing, we're like, that's how we're seeing it. Maybe, you know, we're seeing someone really looking like they're suffering in a hospital bed, the way I saw my dad and was haunted by those images. And mediums are like, he was actually already on the other side. He having a blast.
Having a great time. Yep.
And, you know, his body might have been breathing on all the tubes, but they're like, he wasn't even there.
That's probably right.
Hi, can I ask all of you listening a favor? Would you mind rating and reviewing my book, WTF Just Happened? A Sciencey Skeptic Explores Grief, Healing, and Evidence of an Afterlife on Amazon. Authors depend so much on ratings. They are crucial to the algorithm and Amazon making sure this book is seen. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate it. Thank you.
The strangest story along those lines I've ever heard was a medical doctor near San Francisco named Ron Kennedy. And he had been off on an extended vacation in Europe, and he had a guy who was house-sitting for him. And when he came back, he arrived late in the evening, it was already dark, and the guy who was house-sitting for him had some kind of a psychotic break or a snap or something. So Ron Kennedy comes home and walks into his house, and this guy attacks him with a butcher knife. And Dr. Kennedy's pretty strong guy, but the guy got the jump on him and was stabbing him over and over and over and over again. And fortunately, a neighbor had seen the beginnings of this and dialed 911. And Kennedy's trying to fight against this guy, but it's not working and he's losing a lot of blood. And he had been stabbed well over a dozen times and finally collapses on the floor. And as this is happening, this event where he's being stabbed to death, this sort of panorama opens off down the hallway of his home. And there is his family waiting there for him, giving him comfort and aid and talking to him and telling him everything will be okay. This is what you need to do. Things will be fine. It's not your time yet.
His living family or his past family?
Thank you for the clarification. No, these are people who are already dead on the other side. And so he's being stabbed to death. And the point that he makes over and over again when he speaks is that even somebody who's dying in the most horrendous way, somebody who's being murdered, for example, like him, that death is actually a wonderful thing. it may be painful for a short period of time, but it's actually a very wonderful thing because you see family or friends who are there to greet you, or God, or, you know, Jesus, or the being of light, or the source, or whoever. And it's a wonderful event. It's just a transition, not a horrible thing like we usually think of death. And so Kennedy ultimately comes back, but it's a great story. I've told that to family members of people who have been murdered, and it tends to give them great comfort because they know that their loved one probably had a very similar experience, and it wasn't as horrendous and horrific as they probably assumed it was.
Thank you for sharing that. I think anyone whose family has lost a loved one that way hopefully will get a form of comfort from that.
Yeah, and I do have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stories. So the one I was going to mention to you isn't quite a near-death experience, but it's very, very close, and it kind of shows a dramatic kind of a change. There was a nurse whose first name is Janet, and I will not mention her last name, nor will I mention the name of the patient because she'll get in trouble with all the HIPAA laws for telling me the story. Who knows what'll happen? But at any rate, it's a great story. So she's a Life Flight nurse, University of Utah Medical Center. This happened quite a few years ago. And there's a guy who comes in who is very wealthy. He has a lot of money, and he's had a heart attack, and he's older, and he's kind of angry and bossy. And he's telling his cardiologist and the nurses that they better take good care of him because he's instructed his attorney that if he doesn't get perfect care and he dies, that he's going to sue them and the hospital and everybody else. And so they better give him the best care. And he's just kind of a jerk patient. And so everybody's all worried about giving him good care. And at some point after he's brought in, he has another cardiac arrest. And so everybody's freaking out, going, oh my gosh, we're going to get sued. Let's get a crash cart. Everybody's in. Everybody's freaked out. And they bring him back with the paddles. And he starts cursing at everybody. I told you that you couldn't do this, and you better do not. And he codes again. And now they're all really worried that they're going to get sued. Bad things will happen. And so they bring out the paddles again and get him, and he comes back. And this time he's angry, but all of a sudden it's different. He says, look, they're here for me. What are you doing? Don't bring me back. If I go again, leave me alone. And they're thinking, he's nuts, you know. Are we going to get sued? Are we not going to get sued? And so the long and the short of the story is that he codes again and they bring him back again because you can't just let somebody die. And he says, they're here for me. And so he's finally smiling and he's happy and he's good. And then his heart stops again. And the nurse says, we all tried to get to him again to bring him back, but we couldn't. And I said, well, what do you mean you couldn't? Well, there was just this barrier there. We couldn't get to him. Well, what do you mean there was a barrier there? I don't know. We all tried to get to him, and we just could not get to him physically. Well, did you see something there that was a barrier? No, but we physically couldn't get to him. We couldn't touch him to bring him back. And I thought, that is an interesting story. Not quite a near-death experience, but I guess when it's your time, you will go, and you might even be prevented from getting medical care if it's really your time. And some of the nurses and the doctors started crying, and they were all worried and didn't know what to do, and it all turned out fine in the end, but kind of an abrupt change from some guy who's really angry to somebody who's finally really, really happy and didn't want to go to wanted to go now. It was a great story. Great story from dear nurse Janet.
That's just I don't even know what to think of that. It's like some layer. Was it his loved ones preventing? Was it him out of body? Like, no way. It was funny. It's happy, too. I mean, he sounds like he was a horrible guy. Well, you know what? At that moment, sometimes people, when they're terrified, are not at their best.
That's right.
So I will give him credit that maybe he was absolutely terrified.
He probably was. And I asked her about it, and she thought it was an unseen physical barrier. They just couldn't see it. It's like glass. You can't really see glass, but you can't reach through it either. It was a physical barrier there for them, and they could not get to him. It was just his time to go. Fascinating story.
I've never heard a story like that.
Neither have I, and it's not quite an NDE, but it's pretty close.
It ties into it.
It does tie into it. Yeah, I have stories that aren't quite near-death experiences that have angels helping people too. But anyway,
I'm always happy to hear more.
Here is one more with angels. There was an experience that happened in Cokeville, Wyoming, and it was actually made into a film and a book. The film, I think, is Cokeville Miracle, and it was on one of the network television shows briefly as a recreation. And there's a book that's called When Angels Intervene to Save the Children. And what happens is in this little town, Cokeville, Wyoming, that's right on the Utah-Wyoming border, there's a little grade school, and all the kids in 1 through 6 or however big the school was, you know, they would all fit in one classroom. It's a teeny tiny little school with a couple of teachers. And so some crazy guy named David Young decides that he is going to blow up the school and take all the kids with him to the afterlife where he can be their king or something. The guy's mentally ill. And so he comes into the school with this homemade bomb on a cart and a gun with his girlfriend, and they take over the school and herd all the kids into one classroom. And then they wait, and police show up, and there are all these problems, but it's kind of a standoff. And what happens is these little kids who are afraid in the classroom, several of them, many of them I've interviewed, some of them I haven't, say that people dressed in white came through the roof of the classroom and told them, okay, it's going to be all right. Pretty soon the bomb's going to go off. And so here's what I want you to do. I want you to lay down close to the floor by the window. And when the bomb goes off, just climb out the window and you'll be all right. And so the guy had this trigger mechanism that was attached to his hand, and I guess he became agitated, and the idea was that that would be a deterrent so that nobody was going to shoot him through a window, because then they knew that the bomb would go off and he would kill all these kids. So this was supposed to be a safety thing, but he made some weird move and he set the bomb off himself. And the only people that were killed in that were him and his girlfriend. The children all escaped. Some of them had serious injuries. But later on, many of them, as they were looking through family photos and things, some of them months, some of them years after the experience happened, would see pictures and say, that's the guy who came through the ceiling to help me. And it was their great-great-grandfather or their great-great-grandmother or their uncle so-and-so who had passed on. And the angels that came to save these kids were apparently deceased family members from the other side. And there's a connection. You know, that's also caused me to sort of rethink the idea about reincarnation that some people strongly believe in, that I probably don't. I mean, I keep an open mind on it, but hey, if people are reincarnated, how would you have 2 and 3 and 4 generations there still interconnected, willing to come and help people who were...
Mediums have theories about that. Just
yes, they do.
I don't know. Dr. Jim Tucker's research. I just go with whatever, like Division of Perceptual Studies at University of Virginia. I don't know. Dr. Jim Tucker has some compelling evidence, but
he has some interesting stuff. So I am keeping an open mind. That's one that I still remain somewhat skeptical of. But at any rate, the kids are saved by their deceased relatives, which I think is a great story. The other part of it to me that was compelling was that there were so many of them, and you would have never gotten a whole bunch of kids to make up a story like that who were from different families who had been through some kind of a traumatic thing like that. It's a great film. It's cool.
What's the film called again?
It's called The Cokeville Miracle. Cokeville's the name of the little town. Great little film. So there's a lady named Angie Fenimore, who I met in the late 1980s and become quite good friends with. And she was with her husband in Okinawa, and they had 2 little kids. And she had just horrible postpartum depression. She just was totally depressed. And so she finally decides that she would end her life. And so her husband, who's in the military, is asleep, and her little kids are asleep, and she decides in her mind that they'll all be better off without her anyway. And so she slices up her wrists in the bathtub and goes off to the other side. And she has a life's review. We didn't talk much about life's review, but of course you and your listeners know that happens a lot. And one of the things that really struck her was that she thought her life had no meaning at all and that it was worthless. And she saw that from a very young age, her life had enormous meaning that she never even grasped. And one of the stories that she told was when she was, you know, 3 or 4, really little, her mother took her to what then was an old folks home and what now would be, you know, an assisted living center. And so she sang a song for all these elderly people, many of whom were in wheelchairs. And because this was her life's review and her near-death experience, she saw and felt the reactions and the emotions of the people who heard her sing. And she said, I was just doing this because I was a little kid. My mom told me to. But all the pouring out of love that these older men and women had who were seeing her sing and the joy that it brought to them and the impact it had on their lives and how it made them happy for weeks after, all these things were things that she had never considered. And so she learned that the smallest little things in life, a smile to somebody on the sidewalk, or a little pep talk, or a thank you, or some other kind word, or small little deed that goes completely unnoticed, can have an enormous impact. And the value of our lives on the other side is probably very, very different than the value that we perceive that we have now. And all of our lives probably have far more value than we can imagine because of all of those small little things that we don't even grasp that we do for other people. And by the same token, if you're kind of a nasty, mean, crummy person, you probably, you know, spreads out in the ripples in a bad way. So be a good person. It makes a difference. And the value of your life is probably far greater than you imagine.
I do want to ask you, this is something I think probably a lot of us are bothered by. I don't know if you have any insight into this, but you hear of a lot of people in near-death experiences being given a choice to come back. And I'm here, my listeners are here because our loved ones did not come back.
Yep.
And I know that was something that really bothered me for a long time when I was reading about well, people have the choice. So my dad, was he given a choice? And he was like, no, I'm not going to, I don't care. My daughter is there. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I will tell you one last story that I think has a huge bearing on this, because people wonder how much of life is just random, how much of it is planned. People who are involved in religion, you know, debate all the time about predestination. You have people who say, oh, Jesus is coming back in the future, or the world's going to end and it's prophesied, and so it is certain. There is no, and you think, well, wait a minute, where does free will fit into this? Do you have a choice? Do you not have a choice? Do you have a choice in all life, or is choice just an illusion? And what about choosing your time to die? Can you do that, or is there just a set time? And there's a guy that was pivotal in my thinking about this named Don Wood. And he had a wife and a couple of darling little kids, and he also had cystic fibrosis. If you have cystic fibrosis, most people don't make it to age 30. And it basically, scar tissue builds up in your lungs, and finally you can't breathe and you suffocate and you die. It's a very difficult, difficult, painful disease. And so Don Woods, for whatever reason, had chosen to get married and have a couple of kids, and he had lived to be quite old. He was in his late 30s when all this happened. And he had a near-death experience, and he was sent back and told all would be well. And then he has a second one. I can't remember how much later, a year or two, but it was a while later. And at this point, he can tell the end's getting near. He's on oxygen a lot. He goes to the hospital often, and he knows it's going to be over. And instead of this wonderful, cheerful, loving near-death experience that a lot of people have, he's back in front of this being of light, and he pitches a fit, and he is just angry. None of this is fair. What the heck's going on? I'm going to die. Somebody else is going to marry my wife. Somebody's going to raise my kids. I'm not going to be there to see him grow up. I didn't ask for any of this. This is not fair. Life is not fair. I am just angry. Why are you doing this to me? And all of a sudden, zip, God sends him to what he describes as a place kind of like a classroom. And there's some guy at the front of the classroom, and he sees himself in it. These are a bunch of people who are waiting to be born. And the person at the front of the classroom says, okay, everybody's waiting to be born. And you're going to go to Earth, and you're going to learn all of these things. And he starts listing stuff up on the board. And who knows, maybe it was a chalkboard, or maybe it was a whiteboard, or maybe it was a computer screen. I don't know, but it was something up on the board. And he writes down these different qualities: empathy, love, patience, kindness, you know, all these different virtues. And then the person at the front of the classroom says, and you can do it the normal way, or you can do things a little bit faster. You can choose one of these other things. And the guy is writing up there on the board, cancer, heart attack, myasthenia gravis, multiple sclerosis. And Don Wood sees himself raising his hand and saying, oh yeah, I'll choose that one. And so he realizes that he picked his own fate and his own trials in life. He finally did pass away. But he was told, it's okay, your wife and family will be all right. This is part of your plan. And he and I talked a lot about predestination and free will. And I said, how do you think it works? And we came to the conclusion that life is not haphazard. God wouldn't send us down here for something that wasn't fairly well planned. But then if that's all true, how does free will fit together? And Don was shown through his experience that it's essentially like a day planner. If you're a good person, you have a day planner. You at least to some sense, to some extent, have figured out today and tomorrow and maybe a few days in the future. And who knows, maybe some people have long-term plans. And so you plan things out. But just because you have your day planner doesn't mean that you are forced to do everything on it. There are some things that are probably unmovable, like Don's disease that he had, but other things you probably choose, and you can stick with your plan or change it a little bit. And so I'm a firm believer that ultimately we all have a time to go, and some people may do some things that shorten that up, or maybe that lengthen it for some certain period of time, but not enough that it would damage your overall plan and purpose for life. I'm a firm believer that there's a pretty solid plan for all of us, and that we're here probably. One of the reasons that life is so very, very hard is that we are pushed to the edge. I have a son who was in the Marine Corps for 5 years. He just got out a little bit, and it pushes you. So like the Navy SEAL guys, you know, it pushes you to the edge and then a little bit farther. And for all of us, that's what life's like. Life has all these nice, fun little things in it, but a lot of life is being pushed to the limit and maybe a little bit beyond sometimes. And those are the things that you learn the very, very most from. Most of the things that you learn that are the most important about compassion, about love, about the value of life, about what's important, about what you should pursue, those come from difficult things. You know, if you have a college degree, you're probably very, very proud of it, not because you got it in a Cracker Jack box or at the front of some magazine in a plane and you sent off for a diploma, but because you had to work really freaking hard for a lot of years to get it. And so it really means something. All the things that really mean something take a lot of effort and a lot of work. That's life.
That's a lot to think about and helpful and a lot to process, and gives an answer, I think, to something that can get, you can kind of get stuck in the bitterness of, well, why not my person? Why not my person? Now, you were still, even hearing a lot of these NDEs early on, skeptical. Was there a pivotal moment where, I know I could name maybe a few for me, where I went to one level of, oh my God, this is true, to another level, to another level. Is there some kind of key pivotal moments that you're like, wait, oh my God, this actually is real?
They are. One of them was that little girl, Crystal, who I mentioned earlier, who was telling me things about what was going on at her house that her, and in the hospital when she was in a coma, that her doctor verified and her family verified. And it struck me that the way you can verify near-death experiences, or at least one way, is if you find some, and there are many that are like this, where people acquire knowledge during their near-death experience, you can later verify to be true that they just could not have known. And some of the most fascinating ones are blind people, people who have been blind from birth, who have a near-death experience, and all of a sudden they can see. Your listeners or viewers may be interested in a book called Mind Sight, MindSight. And it has near-death experiences of people who are totally blind and can see during their near-death experience. Some of the more interesting ones are people who saw things that were later verified that they literally could not see because they were blind. And so how could they possibly describe them if they weren't really seeing something during their near-death experience? Bruce Grayson had a, I'm pretty sure it was Bruce Grayson, had Dr. Bruce Grayson had a patient who had a heart attack, an elderly woman. She had been blind since she was a young child. And the nurse, in an effort to get some adrenaline to give it to the doctor who was going to inject it into her heart to get it started again, was having trouble with it. And she finally broke the bottle and cut her finger and made it all happen. And the lady wakes up and told her, you know, that was a brave thing you did, or I'm sorry about your finger, or words to that effect. And she couldn't have seen it. She was off in a different room and she was blind. So how would you explain that? I look for experiences like that. Another famous one was a nurse, Kim Clark in Seattle, had this migrant farm worker lady named Maria who'd come in and describe, this is one of the very early NDEs, and said, yeah, I floated out of my body and I was going around the hospital and floating outside of the hospital. And her nurse, Kim Clark, says, yeah, right, sure. Why should I believe this? This has got to be a hallucination. She said, no, really, really. I know there's a ledge on the third floor of the hospital outside the window. And so Kim Clark sticks her head out the window, looks way down there, and she finally sees the ledge, which there's no way the patient, this Maria lady, could have seen it. And that was another one that has that quality to it of somebody acquiring knowledge during the experience they just could not have had. Couldn't see the tennis shoe from the street, looking up at the ledge. It was too far back. You couldn't see it in the room. She was in a hospital bed. Either the nurse and the patient are lying, or it happened. Those are the kinds of things I look for. Maybe the most dramatic one is Pam Reynolds and her surgery. Are you familiar with the Pam Reynolds near-death experience?
Tell it to our listeners. I don't think most of them are.
Most of them are probably not. Pam Reynolds was a country singer in Nashville, and she started to have headaches and blackouts, and she was finally ultimately diagnosed with a brain tumor at the base of her brain, and she couldn't find anybody for quite a while who would operate because she was given a very low chance of survival, and she finally found Dr. Spetzler in Phoenix who would do the surgery. And the surgery took hours and hours and hours, and it's called the standstill procedure. Because to do this procedure and not have your brain bleed out, what they do is they put you under with anesthetic, they lower your body temperature to about 60 degrees, they stop your heart, they stop your respiration. They put little earbuds in your ears and they chirp. And then when your brain waves stop, they're ready for the surgery. That means you are clinically dead in every measurable way. You have no brain waves. You have no respiration. Your eyes are taped shut. Your heart is stopped. You're dead. You're dead. And the surgery starts. And so after the surgery was completed and it was successful, Pam Reynolds told her doctor, Spetzler, who's kind of a skeptic. I guess he would be self-described as an agnostic. Pam Reynolds describes the operating table and the saw that they used to cut a hole in her skull. You know, they cut a little chunk of her skull so they could get access to her brain, and described it as looking like an electric toothbrush. And if you look at it, it looks like this little brass toothbrush, and that's what they used to cut a hole in her skull. And she described other parts of the procedure, how they had a tough time finding a vein that would work in one leg and had to use a different one. Anyway, the whole procedure was something that she could not have known about. She couldn't have heard it. If she'd heard anything, it would have registered on the brain waves. She couldn't have seen it. Her eyes were taped shut. It's a fascinating example of it. And it's also very persuasive because it's extremely well documented. They have the whole procedure and all of her medical records. And it's easy to prove that this was an experience that actually happened. So Pam wakes up and describes all this. And her experience it has been quite a famous one. She finally died, I think, about 10 years ago now, a second time, and is gone. But you can find her experience on the internet, I'm sure, in several places. Pam Reynolds, NDE. It's a great, great story.
Yeah, that was an amazing one. I remember that was one of the early ones I found. I want to ask your opinion. Do you think NDEs are real? Because there's still a lot of question. Are they a hallucination to help us face the terror of our dying? What do you think?
I'm convinced they're real, but there are some good studies to try to test that. At the back of Moody's book, Life After Life, he maps out some of the alternatives. One is, oh, maybe they're drug-induced. And it turns out that in the studies that have been done, if you are given drugs in surgery or medical procedure, you're actually less likely to have a near-death experience, not more. And to me, that means it probably suppresses your memory if you had one. And so you're more likely to have one without drugs. So it's not drug-induced. Another possibility is that it's some kind of a hallucination. And when I ask people if it's a dream or a hallucination, which I often ask, they will say, I've had a lot of dreams in my life. Haven't you? And I will say, of course. And they'll say, do you know the difference between a dream and when you're awake? Yeah, I do. And they will say, a dream is not a near-death experience. A hallucination is not a near-death experience. I've even talked to people who were under the influence of either hospital or street drugs who had an accident that resulted in a near-death experience and who were all of a sudden lucid. And so they said their near-death experience was definitely not drug-induced or a hallucination. Most of them describe the time on the other side as more real than waking life. And so there's not any real evidence for some alternative explanation other than that these really are, from the people who experience them, something that's a glimpse of the other side. And I believe that to be true for a number of reasons, especially going back to the kids' near-death experiences. If they were afraid of death or some impending death, what would they come up with? I'm not sure they would come up with a near-death experience. They might be playing in a sandbox or watching TV. I don't know. But their descriptions are virtually the same as near-death experiences in adults.
Yeah, and you can look back at kid fantasy. I remember imagining what heaven was like because, again, I was raised very secular. I'm not, you know, telling this for anyone to believe. My parents were like, oh, when you die, you go to heaven. And I was a little bit older, like six, like, oh, yeah, and, you know, no, that's true. You die, you die. I mean, they weren't quite that brutal, but that was just the trajectory. So I remember being very little and being like, well, I know I have, like, grandparents and great-grandparents up there. And I was picturing in clouds with,
yep,
you know, a lot of toys, very fantasy-based.
Very fantasy-based.
And so if you'd asked me at like 5 years old what was dying like, I would have been like in clouds in heaven.
That's right. That's right. So when they say something different than that, you tend to think it's real. You tend to think it's real.
If you could have an NDE, would you?
No. And I'll tell you why. Most of the people that I know who have had near-death experiences have severe problems because of them. Number one, they're in the after-death movie, for example, Howard Storm's a good example. I just love that guy. It changed him from an atheist Northern Kentucky University art professor to a believer who decided that his calling was to go back and become a Unitarian minister. And that did not work for his wife, who was an attorney. And she left him, and his kids thought he was crazy. And it changed him so much that it, in some ways, just changed his life for the better. And in other ways, changed it for the worse. One of my co-founders of Utah Ions, or actually came shortly after it was co-founded, but is a guy who used to be an extreme athlete. He was in 100-mile races and crazy things like that. He had a near-death experience. He's in a wheelchair because his back was broken. most people who have near-death experiences have them in very dramatic ways, and there are a lot of huge side effects. And my friend Bill English, who's in a wheelchair, says he would never trade his near-death experience away to get use of his legs back, which kind of tells you right there that he knows it's real and it's amazing. But maybe I'm timid, but I would prefer to learn about near-death experiences from other people and in books and learn all the cool things about them without being in a wheelchair or having major problems from an accident or coming out of a coma or being in a car wreck or whatever. So, but it would be amazing. That would take away the faith element and move it into an absolute knowledge.
Yeah, the only people I've ever met who say 100% they're absolutely convinced, except some people who are just being dogmatic, belief-based, but truly people who are not dogmatists, if I don't know if that's a real word, but if not, I just made it up.
That's a real word.
That's a real word, okay.
Yeah.
People who are not dogmatists, the only people I've ever met who are 100% without a doubt are people who've had an NDE, and that is definitely tempting to know you could go through that life with that level of certainty. And they all say they absolutely don't fear death.
Yes.
I mean, those are huge trade-offs.
They are huge, huge trade-offs, but there are some real benefits. You're right. Some huge benefits.
Regarding skeptics, what do you think are some of the best books or sources for people who are feeling really skeptical, but hopeful, would like to have some tangible reasons to hope?
Sure. The one I mentioned, MindSight, I think is a really good one. Near-death experiences of people who are blind. Other ones that I think are good are from people who have credibility and you would trust and who are not likely to fib or lie or embellish something. Let me say something here for the people who are skeptics. I have sort of a litmus test for people who have near-death experiences or claim to have one. And I am absolutely convinced they're real, but I also am convinced that some people embellish them for whatever reason, because they want to sound more interesting or they want their experience to be more amazing. I also believe people just make them up out of whole cloth for the same reason. And one of the ways that you can tend to see that is, or see through that, is if people say things that really don't make sense or don't coincide with other near-death experiences. And if you see enough of them, read enough about them, then you'll see something. If it's way off out in left field, maybe it's not real. Another thing is, we will occasionally have speak at Utah Ion someone who, no matter what question they're asked, they'll answer it. Near-death experience people who are real, they like to tell the truth. And so if somebody raises their hand and asks them a question, they will say that's outside of the scope of their experience. I have no idea. That wasn't part of my experience. I really don't know what to say about that. People who tend to embellish them, you could raise your hand and ask them a question, say, so tell me what happens to the spirits of monkeys who lived in the 9th century in Burma, and they will answer it. They're like the world's expert on everything. And when you hear somebody like that, you think, maybe nobody's going to have that in their near-death experience, and maybe they're giving you an opinion, but maybe they're embellishing. Those are the kinds of people I tend to be skeptical of.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think anyone who knows too much and can't say they don't know anything, that makes me wary too.
Very much so. Very much so.
You ever wonder what mediums do with their free time? How about a 30-something-year-old gay medium living in New York City? Well, in this podcast, you're about to find out. Welcome to Ghost Daddy, a place where LGBTQ+ spiritual people and our cis-hetero allies, of course, have a place to just be themselves and spread their wisdom. This is the new face of spirituality. None of that love and light, toxic positivity crap. So pour yourself a vodka soda, open up your mind, and start listening. You can listen to the Ghost Daddy podcast anywhere where you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm interrupting the podcast episode for this week's listener question.
Okay, so this isn't exactly a question about afterlife evidence, but it's a great question. Aaron asks, what's the dumbest thing I've ever heard about grief? Oh my God, how do I choose one? There's so many. I think overall, it's just anyone or anytime someone thinks they know better than you about how to handle your grief. Even if they've had a loss, that doesn't mean they know what's right for you to do. So I'd say almost anything that starts with you need to or you should, because how would they know what you need to do? And anything that disrespects your grieving process is really just, ugh, don't. No, it's not helpful. And some of the classics that we all unfortunately know, they're in a better place. This was meant to be. Be grateful that, at least. And just really the best thing to do and the best people to surround yourself with in grief are those that respect your individual process and respect your own individual process. There's no right way. There's no wrong way. Sometimes your way and your best friend's way, if you've both had grief, might be completely different. Your way of handling grief might be completely different than how you thought you would handle it. And maybe you handle it differently this week than you did the week before. So just respect your process.
If you have a question you want me to answer, send it to hello@wtfjusthappened.net and put question of the week in the subject. I know I usually say first names, but if you want to be completely anonymous, let me know. And feel free to reach out anyway, even if you don't have a question. I can't wait to hear your questions and hear from you.
So is there anything I haven't asked you that you want to share? Anything else you would like to share with our listeners?
Well, go see the new After Death film. It's really well done. It's by far the best thing I've ever seen on the subject. I know almost all the people in it, not every one of the people, but the experiences are real well filmed and well presented by someone who is by a good filmmaker who is genuinely trying to figure out if these are experiences are real because he lost a brother-in-law recently. So it's a great film from kind of a skeptic turn believer, filmmaker, director, producer. There are some really fabulous books. Be picky, be careful in looking at books. If you go to some of the better ones, some of the better ones are done by people with good credentials, like medical doctors, like scientists who are careful. Some of the more interesting ones that skeptics might be interested in also might be some of the older ones that are out of print. There's one called Adventures in Immortality, which I always thought was kind of a weird title, but it's by George Gallup, the pollster. So he's doing polls about near-death experiences, and they're scientifically accurate because this guy was a pollster and he knows what he's doing and he knows how to make them accurate. And so you get scientifically sound information from the general public about near-death experiences. Those might be a few good places to start.
Right. I haven't heard of some of those books, so I'm excited to read them. And I definitely want to go see that film and maybe try to get the filmmaker on the podcast. So I'll see what I can do with that. Okay, so where can our listeners find you, follow you, stay up to date?
I do a radio show that's turned into a podcast once a week out of KSL Radio in Salt Lake. It's called Religion Today, and it's not about religious dogma and doctrine so much as You know, I look at near-death experiences, archaeology, science and religion, all kinds of different things. So somebody wants to type in religion today and Martin Tanner, they can find me on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, KSL Podcasts, any of those places, or just send me an email. I martinstanner@gmail.com. Anybody can ask me any question about near-death experiences. I'm always happy to answer.
To get more information on what the fuck just happened, go to WTFjustHappened.net. There you can order my book, WTF Just Happened, A Sciencey Skeptic Explores Grief, Healing, and Evidence of an Afterlife. You can learn all about how I came to conclude that there most likely is an afterlife, but you can also learn about the early stages of my grief and the amazing, fascinating people I met along the way. You can read about how much I harassed the mediums and scientists trying to get evidence to see if the mediums were cheating and see if what everyone was saying actually was true. You can also subscribe to our newsletter to stay updated on any new developments and any interesting new what the fuck updates. So if you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. It makes such a difference, especially for a new podcast like this one. And if any of you have had a crazy what the fuck yourself, have any questions, feedback, or just want to say hey, reach out on either Instagram at WTF_just_happened_ or email me at hello@WTFjustHappened.net. I love hearing from all of you. It makes my day hearing your stories and questions and feedback and all of it. And remember, you don't have to draw any final conclusions as you wonder, what the fuck just happened?